re-evaporation, for example with water oceans made by melting a large icy moon transported from the outer solar system. Then the carbon dioxide might conceivably be sequestered away, and Venus converted into a water, or low-fizz seltzer, planet. Ways have also been suggested to convert the carbon dioxide into carbonate rock. Thus, all proposals for terraforming Venus are still brute force, inelegant, and absurdly expensive. The desired planetary metamorphosis may be beyond our reach for a very long time, even if we thought it was desirable and responsible. The Asian colonization of Venus that Jack Williamson imagined may have to be redirected somewhere else. Mars. For Mars, we have just the opposite problem. There's not enough greenhouse effect. The planet is a frozen desert. But the fact that Mars seems to have had abundant rivers, lakes, and perhaps even oceans 4 billion years ago, at a time when the sun was less bright than it is today, makes you wonder if there's some natural instability in the Martian climate, something on hair trigger that once released would all by itself return the planet to its ancient, clement state. Let's note from the start that doing so would destroy Martian landforms that hold key data on the past, especially the laminated polar terrain. As we know very well from Earth and Venus, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. There are carbonate minerals found on Mars and dry ice in one of the polar caps. They could be converted into carbon dioxide gas. But to make enough of a greenhouse effect to generate comfortable temperatures on Mars would require the entire surface of the planet to be plowed up and processed to a depth of kilometers. Apart from the daunting obstacles in practical engineering that this represents, fusion power or no fusion power, and the inconvenience to whatever self-contained, closed ecological systems humans had already established on the planet, it would also constitute the irresponsible destruction of the unique scientific resource and database, the Martian surface. What about other greenhouse gases? Alternatively, we might take chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs or HCFCs, to Mars after manufacturing them on Earth. These are artificial substances that, so far as we know, are found nowhere else in the solar system. We can certainly imagine manufacturing enough CFCs on Earth to warm Mars. Because by accident, in a few decades with present technology on Earth, we managed to synthesize enough to contribute to global warming on our planet. Transportation to Mars would be expensive, though. Even using Saturn V or Energia-class boosters, it would require at least a launch a day for a century. But perhaps they could be manufactured from fluorine-containing minerals on Mars. There is, in addition, a serious drawback. On Mars, as on Earth, abundant CFCs would prevent formation of an ozone layer. CFCs might bring Martian temperatures into a clement range, but guarantee that the solar ultraviolet hazard would remain extremely serious. Perhaps the solar ultraviolet light could be absorbed by an atmospheric layer of pulverized asteroidal or surface debris injected in carefully titrated amounts above the CFCs. But now we're in the troubling circumstance of having to deal with propagating side effects, each of which requires its own large-scale technological solution. A third possible greenhouse gas for warming Mars is ammonia, NH3. Only a little ammonia would be enough to warm the Martian surface to above the freezing point of water. In principle, this might be done by specially engineered microorganisms that would convert Martian atmospheric nitrogen to ammonia, as some microbes do on Earth, but do it under Martian conditions. Or the same conversion might be done in special factories. Alternatively, the nitrogen required could be carried to Mars from elsewhere in the solar system. Nitrogen is the principal constituent in the atmospheres of both Earth and Titan. Ultraviolet light would convert ammonia back into nitrogen in about 30 years, so there would have to be a continuous resupply of ammonia. A judicious combination of carbon dioxide, CFC, and ammonia greenhouse effects on Mars looks as if it might be able to bring surface temperatures close enough to the freezing point of water for the second phase of Martian terraforming to begin. Temperatures rising due to the pressure of substantial water vapor in the air, widespread production of oxygen by genetically engineered plants, and fine-tuning the surface environment. Microbes and larger plants and animals could be established on Mars before the overall environment was suitable for unprotected human settlers. Terraforming Mars is plainly much easier than terraforming Venus, but it is still very expensive by present standards and environmentally destructive. If there were sufficient justification, though, perhaps the terraforming of Mars could be underway by the 22nd century. The moons of Jupiter and Saturn. Terraforming the satellites of the Jovian planets presents varying degrees of difficulty. Perhaps the easiest to contemplate is Titan. It already has an atmosphere made mainly of nitrogen like the Earth's, and is much closer to terrestrial atmospheric pressures than either Venus or Mars. Moreover, important greenhouse gases, such as ammonia and water, are almost certainly frozen out on its surface. Manufacture of initial greenhouse gases that do not freeze out at present Titan temperatures, plus direct warming of the surface by nuclear fusion, could, it seems, be the key early steps to one day terraform Titan. If there were a compelling reason for terraforming other worlds, this greatest of engineering projects might be feasible on the timescale we've been describing. Certainly for asteroids, possibly for Mars, Titan, and other moons of the outer planets, and probably not for Venus. Pollack and I recognized that there are those who feel a powerful attraction to the idea of rendering other worlds in the solar system suitable for human habitation, in establishing observatories, exploratory bases, communities, and homesteads there. Because of its pioneering history, this may be a particularly natural and attractive idea in the United States. In any case, massive alteration of the environments of other worlds can be done competently and responsibly only when we have a much better understanding of those worlds than is available today. Advocates of terraforming must first become advocates of the long-term and thorough scientific exploration of other worlds. Perhaps when we really understand the difficulties of terraforming, the costs or the environmental penalties will prove too steep, and we will lower our sights to domed or subsurface cities or other local closed ecological systems, greatly improved versions of Biosphere 2 on other worlds. Perhaps we will abandon the dream of converting the surfaces of other worlds to something approaching the Earth's. Or perhaps there are much more elegant, cost-effective, and environmentally responsible ways of terraforming that we have not yet imagined. But if we are seriously to pursue the matter, certain questions ought to be asked. Given that any terraforming scheme entails a balance of benefits against costs. How certain must we be that key scientific information will not thereby be destroyed before proceeding? How much understanding of the world in question do we need before planetary engineering can be relied upon to produce the desired end state? Can we guarantee a long-term human commitment to maintain and replenish an engineered world when human political institutions are so short-lived? If a world is even conceivably inhabited, perhaps only by microorganisms, do humans have the right to alter it? What is our responsibility to preserve the worlds of the solar system in their present wilderness states for future generations, who may contemplate uses that today we are too ignorant to foresee? These questions may perhaps be encapsulated into a final question. Can we, who have made such a mess of this world, be trusted with others? It is just conceivable that some of the techniques that might eventually terraform other worlds might be applied to ameliorate the damage we have done to this one. Considering the relative urgencies, a useful indication of when the human species is ready to consider terraforming seriously is when we have put our own world right. We can consider it a test of the depth of our understanding and our commitment. The first step in engineering the solar system is to guarantee the habitability of the Earth. Then we'll be ready to spread out to asteroids, comets, Mars, the moons of the outer solar system, and beyond. Jack Williamson's prediction that this will begin to come about by the 22nd century may not be far off the mark. The notion of our descendants living and working on other worlds, and even moving some of them around for their convenience, seems the most extravagant science fiction. Be realistic, a voice inside my head counsels. But this is realistic. We're on the cusp of the technology, near the midpoint between impossible and routine. It's easy to be conflicted about it. If we don't do something awful to ourselves in the interim, in another century, terraforming may seem no more impossible than a human-tended space station does today. I think the experience of living on other worlds is bound to change us. Our descendants, born and raised elsewhere, will naturally begin to owe primary loyalty to the worlds of their birth, whatever affection they retain for the Earth. Their physical needs, their methods of supplying those needs, their technologies, and their social structures will all have to be different. A blade of grass is a commonplace on Earth. It would be a miracle on Mars. Our descendants on Mars will know the value of a patch of green. And if a blade of grass is priceless, what is the value of a human being? The American revolutionary Tom Paine, in describing his contemporaries, had thoughts along these lines. The wants which necessarily accompany the cultivation of a wilderness produced among them a state of society which countries long harassed by the quarrels and intrigues of governments had neglected to cherish. In such a situation, man becomes what he ought to be. He sees his species as kindred. Having seen at first hand a procession of barren and desolate worlds, it will be natural for our spacefaring descendants to cherish life. Having learned something from the tenure of our species on Earth, they may wish to apply those lessons to other worlds, to spare generations to come the avoidable suffering that their ancestors were obliged to endure, and to draw upon our experience and our mistakes as we begin our open-ended evolution into space. Chapter 20. Darkness. Far away, hidden from the eyes of daylight, there are watchers in the skies. Euripides, the Bacchae, circa 406 BC. As children, we fear the dark. Anything might be out there. The unknown troubles us. Ironically, it is our fate to live in the dark. This unexpected finding of science is only about 3 centuries old. Head out from the Earth in any direction you choose and, after an initial flash of blue and a longer wait while the sun fades, you are surrounded by blackness, punctuated only here and there by the faint and distant stars. Even after we are grown, the darkness retains its power to frighten us. And so there are those who say we should not inquire too closely into who else might be living in that darkness. Better not to know, they say. There are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Of this immense multitude, could it be that our humdrum sun is the only one with an inhabited planet? Maybe. Maybe the origin of life or intelligence is exceedingly improbable. Or maybe civilizations arise all the time, but wipe themselves out as soon as they are able. Or, here and there, peppered across space, orbiting other suns, maybe there are worlds something like our own, on which other beings gaze up and wonder as we do. About who else lives in the dark? Could the Milky Way be rippling with life and intelligence? Worlds calling out to worlds, while we on Earth are alive at the critical moment when we first decide to listen. Our species has discovered a way to communicate through the dark, to transcend immense distances. No means of communication is faster. Or cheaper, or reaches out farther. It's called radio. After billions of years of biological evolution on their planet and ours, an alien civilization cannot be in technological lockstep with us. There have been humans for more than 20,000 centuries, but we've had radio for only about 1 century. If alien civilizations are behind us, they're likely to be too far behind to have radio. And if they're ahead of us, they're likely to be far ahead of us. Think of the technical advances on our world over just the last few centuries. What is for us technologically difficult or impossible, what might seem to us like magic, might for them be trivially easy. They might use other, very advanced means to communicate with their peers, but they would know about radio as an approach to newly emerging civilizations. Even with no more than our level of technology at the transmitting and receiving ends, we could communicate today across much of the galaxy. They should be able to do much better. If they exist. But our fear of the dark rebels. The idea of alien beings troubles us. We conjure up objections. It's too expensive. But in its fullest modern technological expression, it costs less than 1 attack helicopter a year. I'll never understand what they're saying. But because the message is transmitted by radio, we and they must have radio physics, radio astronomy, and radio technology in common. The laws of nature are the same everywhere, So science itself provides a means and language of communication, even between very different kinds of beings, provided they both have science. Figuring out the message, if we're fortunate enough to receive one, may be much easier than acquiring it. It would be demoralizing to learn that our science is primitive. But by the standards of the next few centuries, at least some of our present science will be considered primitive, extraterrestrials or no extraterrestrials. So will some of our present politics, ethics, economics, and religion. To go beyond present science is one of the chief goals of science. Serious students are not commonly plunged into fits of despair on turning the pages of a textbook and discovering that some further topic is known to the author, but not yet to the student. Usually the students struggle a little, acquire the new knowledge, and following an ancient human tradition, continue to turn the pages. All through history, advanced civilizations have ruined civilizations just slightly more backward. Certainly. But malevolent aliens, should they exist, will not discover our existence from the fact that we listen. The search programs only receive. They do not send. Surprisingly, many people, including New York Times editorialists, are concerned that once extraterrestrials know where we are, they will come here and eat us. Put aside the profound biological differences that must exist between the hypothetical aliens and ourselves. Imagine that we constitute an interstellar gastronomic delicacy. Why transport large numbers of us to alien restaurants? The freightage is enormous. Wouldn't it be better just to steal a few humans, sequence our amino acids, or whatever else is the source of our delectability, and then just synthesize the identical food product from scratch? The debate is, for the moment, moot. We are now, on an unprecedented scale, listening for radio signals from possible other civilizations in the depths of space. Alive today is the first generation of scientists to interrogate the darkness. Conceivably, it might also be the last generation before contact is made. And this, the last moment, before we discover that someone in the darkness is calling out to us. This quest is called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI. Let me describe how far we've come. The first SETI program was carried out by Frank Drake at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Greenbank, West Virginia, in 1960. He listened to two nearby sun-like stars for 2 weeks at one particular frequency. Nearby is a relative term. The nearest was 12 light-years, 70 trillion miles away. Almost at the moment Drake pointed the radio telescope and turned the system on, he picked up a very strong signal. Was it a message from alien beings? Then it went away. If the signal disappears, you can't scrutinize it. You can't see if, because of the Earth's rotation, it moves with the sky. If it's not repeatable, you've learned almost nothing from it. It might be terrestrial radio interference, or a failure of your amplifier or detector, or an alien signal. Unrepeatable data, no matter how illustrious the scientists reporting them, are not worth much. Weeks later, the signal was detected again. It turned out to be a military aircraft broadcasting on an unauthorized frequency. Drake reported negative results. But in science, a negative result is not at all the same thing as a failure. His great achievement was to show that modern technology is fully able to listen for signals from hypothetical civilizations on the planets of other stars. Since then, there have been a number of attempts, often on time borrowed from other radio telescope observing programs, and almost never for longer than a few months. There have been some more false alarms at Ohio State, in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, in France, Russia, and elsewhere, but nothing that could pass muster with the world scientific community. Meanwhile, the technology for detection has been getting cheaper. The sensitivity keeps improving. The scientific respectability of SETI has continued to grow, and even NASA and Congress have become a little less afraid to support it. Diverse, complementary search strategies are possible and necessary. It was clear years ago that if the trend continued, the technology for a comprehensive SETI effort would eventually fall within the reach even of private organizations or wealthy individuals, and sooner or later, the government would be willing to support a major program. After 30 years of work, for some of us, it's been later rather than sooner. But at last, the time has come. The Planetary Society, a non-profit membership organization that Bruce Murray, then the director of JPL, and I founded in 1980, is devoted to planetary exploration and the search for extraterrestrial life. Paul Horowitz, a physicist at Harvard University, had made a number of important innovations for SETI and was eager to try them out. If we could find the money to get him started, we thought we could continue to support the program by donations from our members. In 1983, Anne Drian and I suggested to the filmmaker Steven Spielberg that this was an ideal project for him to support. Breaking with Hollywood tradition, he had in two wildly successful movies conveyed the idea that extraterrestrial beings might not be hostile and dangerous. Spielberg agreed. With his initial support through the Planetary Society, Project META began. META is an acronym for Megachannel Extraterrestrial Assay. The single frequency of Drake's first system grew to 8.4 million. But each channel, each station we tune to, has an exceptionally narrow frequency range. There are no known processes out among the stars and galaxies that can generate such sharp radio lines. If we pick up anything falling into so narrow a channel, it must, we think, be a token of intelligence and technology. What's more, the Earth turns, which means that any distant radio source will have a sizable apparent motion, like the rising and setting of the stars. Just as the steady tone of a car's horn dips as it drives by, so any authentic extraterrestrial radio source will exhibit a steady drift in frequency due to the Earth's rotation. In contrast, any source of radio interference at the Earth's surface will be rotating at the same speed as the META receiver. META's listening frequencies are continuously changed to compensate for the Earth's rotation, so that any narrowband signals from the sky will always appear in a single channel. But any radio interference down here on Earth will give itself away by racing through adjacent channels. The META radio telescope at Harvard, Massachusetts is 26 meters, 84 feet, in diameter. Each day, as the Earth rotates the telescope beneath the sky, a swath of stars narrower than the full moon is swept out and examined. Next day, it's an adjacent swath. Over a year, all of the northern sky and part of the southern is observed. An identical system, also sponsored by the Planetary Society, is in operation just outside Buenos Aires, Argentina, to examine the southern sky. So together, the two META systems have been exploring the entire sky. The radio telescope, gravitationally glued to the spinning Earth, looks at any given star for about 2 minutes. Then it's on to the next. 8.4 million channels sounds like a lot, but remember, each channel is very narrow. All of them together constitute only a few parts in 100,000 of the available radio spectrum. So we have to park our 8.4 million channels somewhere in the radio spectrum for each year of observation, near some frequency that an alien civilization, knowing nothing about us, might nevertheless conclude we're listening to. Hydrogen is by far the most abundant kind of atom in the universe. It's distributed in clouds and as diffuse gas throughout interstellar space. When it acquires energy, it releases some of it by giving off radio waves at a precise frequency of 1420.405751768 megahertz. 1 hertz means the crest and trough of a wave arriving at your detection instrument each second. So 1420 megahertz means 1.420 billion waves entering your detector every second. Since the wavelength of light is just the speed of light divided by the frequency of the wave, 1420 megahertz corresponds to a wavelength of 21 centimeters. Radio astronomers anywhere in the galaxy will be studying the universe at 1420 megahertz and can anticipate that other radio astronomers, no matter how different they may look, will do the same. It's as if someone told you that there's only one station on your home radio set's frequency band, but that no one knows its frequency. Oh yes, one other thing. Your set's frequency dial, with its thin marker you adjust by turning a knob, happens to reach from the Earth to the Moon. To search systematically through this vast radio spectrum, patiently turning the knob is going to be very time-consuming. Your problem is to set the dial correctly from the beginning, to choose the right frequency. If you can correctly guess what frequencies that extraterrestrials are broadcasting to us on, the magic frequencies, then you can save yourself much time and trouble. These are the sorts of reasons that we first listened, as Drake did, at frequencies near 1420 megahertz, the hydrogen magic frequency. Horowitz and I have published detailed results from 5 years of full-time searching with Project Meta and 2 years of follow-up. We can't report that we found a signal from alien beings, but we did find something puzzling. Something that for me, in quiet moments, every now and then, raises goosebumps. Of course, there's a background level of radio noise from Earth, radio and television stations, aircraft, portable telephones nearby, and more distant spacecraft. Also, as with all radio receivers, the longer you wait, the more likely it is that there'll be some random fluctuation in the electronics so strong that it generates a spurious signal. So we ignore anything that isn't much louder than the background. Any strong narrowband signal that remains in a single channel we take very seriously. As it logs in the data, Meta automatically tells the human operators to pay attention to certain signals. Over 5 years, we made some 60 trillion observations at various frequencies while examining the entire accessible sky. A few dozen signals survived the culling. These are subjected to further scrutiny, and almost all of them are rejected. For example, because an error has been found by fault detection microprocessors that examine the signal detection microprocessors. What's left, the strongest candidate signals after 3 surveys of the sky, are 11 events. They satisfy all but one of our criteria for a genuine alien signal. But the one failed criterion is supremely important. Verifiability. We've never been able to find any of them again. We look back at that part of the sky 3 minutes later, and there's nothing there. We look again the following day, nothing. Examine it a year later, or 7 years later, and still there's nothing. It seems unlikely that every signal we get from alien civilizations would turn itself off a couple of minutes after we begin listening and never repeat. How would they know we're paying attention? But just possibly this is the effect of twinkling. Stars twinkle because parcels of turbulent air are moving across the line of sight between the star and us. Sometimes these air parcels act as a lens and cause the light rays from a given star to converge a little, making it momentarily brighter. Similarly, astronomical radio sources may also twinkle, owing to clouds of electrically charged or ionized gas in the great near vacuum between the stars. We observe this routinely with pulsars. Imagine a radio signal that's a little below the strength that we could otherwise detect on Earth. Occasionally, the signal will, by chance, be temporarily focused, amplified, and brought within the detectability range of our telescopes. The interesting thing is that the lifetimes of such brightening, predicted from the physics of the interstellar gas, are a few minutes. And the chance of reacquiring the signal is small. We should really be pointing steadily at these coordinates in the sky, watching them for months. Despite the fact that none of these signals repeats, there's an additional fact about them that every time I think about it, sends a chill down my spine. 8 of the 11 best candidate signals lie in or near the plane of the Milky Way galaxy. The 5 strongest are in the constellations Cassiopeia, Monoceros, Hydra, and 2 in Sagittarius, in the approximate direction of the center of the galaxy. The Milky Way is a flat, wheel-like collection of gas and dust and stars. Its flatness is why we see it as a band of diffuse light across the night sky. That's where almost all the stars in our galaxy are. If our candidate signals really were radio interference from Earth or some undetected glitch in the detection electronics, we shouldn't see them preferentially when we're pointing at the Milky Way. But maybe we had an especially unlucky and misleading run of statistics. The probability that this correlation with the galactic plane is due merely to chance is less than 0.5%. Imagine a wall-sized map of the sky, ranging from the North Star at the top to the fainter stars toward which the Earth's south pole points at the bottom. Snaking across this wall map are the irregular boundaries of the Milky Way. Now suppose that you were blindfolded and asked to throw 5 darts at random at the map, with much of the southern sky inaccessible from Massachusetts declared off limits. You'd have to throw the set of 5 darts more than 200 times before, by accident, you got them to fall as closely within the precincts of the Milky Way as the 5 strongest meta-signals did. Without repeatable signals, though, there's no way we can conclude that we've actually found extraterrestrial intelligence. Or maybe the events we found are caused by some new kind of astrophysical phenomenon, something that nobody has thought of yet, by which not civilizations, but stars or gas clouds or something that do lie in the plane of the Milky Way emit strong signals in bafflingly narrow frequency bands. Let's permit ourselves, though, a moment of extravagant speculation. Let's imagine that all our surviving events are in fact due to radio beacons of other civilizations. Then we can estimate, from how little time we spent watching each piece of sky, how many such transmitters there are in the entire Milky Way. The answer is something approaching a million. If randomly strewn through space, the nearest of them would be a few hundred light years away, too far for them to have picked up our own TV or radar signals yet. They would not know for another few centuries that a technical civilization has emerged on Earth. The galaxy would be pulsing with life and intelligence, but unless they're busily exploring huge numbers of obscure star systems, wholly oblivious of what has been happening down here lately. A few centuries from now, after they do hear from us, things might get very interesting. Fortunately, we'd have many generations to prepare. If, on the other hand, none of our candidate signals is an authentic alien radio beacon, then we're forced to the conclusion that very few civilizations are broadcasting, maybe none, at least at our magic frequencies, and strongly enough for us to hear. Consider a civilization like our own, but which dedicated all its available power, about 10 trillion watts, to broadcasting a beacon signal at one of our magic frequencies and to all directions in space. The meta results would then imply that there are no such civilizations out to 25 light years, a volume that encompasses perhaps a dozen sun-like stars. This is not a very stringent limit. If, in contrast, that civilization were broadcasting directly at our position in space, using an antenna no more advanced than the Arecibo Observatory, then if Meta has found nothing, it follows that there are no such civilizations anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy. Out of 400 billion stars, not one. But even assuming they would want to, how would they know to transmit in our direction? Now consider at the opposite technological extreme, a very advanced civilization omnidirectionally and extravagantly broadcasting at a power level 10 trillion times greater. 10 to the 26th power watts, the entire energy output of a star like the sun. Then, if the meta results are negative, we can conclude not only that there are no such civilizations in the Milky Way, but none out to 70 million light years. None in M31, the nearest galaxy like our own. None in M33, or the Fornax system, or M81, or the Whirlpool Nebula, or Centaurus A, or the Virgo cluster of galaxies, or the nearest Seyfert galaxies. None among any of the 100 trillion stars in thousands of nearby galaxies. Stake through its heart or not, the geocentric conceit stirs again. Of course, it might be a token not of intelligence, but of stupidity to pour so much energy into interstellar and intergalactic communication. Perhaps they have good reasons not to hail all comers, or perhaps they don't care about civilizations as backward as we are. But still, not one civilization in 100 trillion stars broadcasting with such power on such a frequency. If the meta results are negative, we have set an instructive limit. But whether on the abundance of very advanced civilizations, or their communication strategy, we have no way of knowing. Even if Meta has found nothing, a broad middle range remains open of abundant civilizations more advanced than we and broadcasting omnidirectionally at magic frequencies. We would not have heard from them yet. On October 12, 1992, auspiciously or otherwise. The 500th anniversary of the so-called discovery of America by Christopher Columbus, NASA turned on its new SETI program. At a radio telescope in the Mojave Desert, a search was initiated intended to cover the entire sky systematically. Like Meta, making no guesses about which stars are more likely, but greatly expanding the frequency coverage. At the Arecibo Observatory, an even more sensitive NASA study began that concentrated on promising nearby star systems. When fully operational, the NASA searches would have been able to detect much fainter signals than Meta and look for kinds of signals that Meta could not. The Meta experience reveals a thicket of background static and radio interference. Quick re-observation and confirmation of the signal, especially at other independent radio telescopes, is the key to being sure. Horowitz and I gave NASA scientists the coordinates of our fleeting and enigmatic events. Perhaps they would be able to confirm and clarify our results. The NASA program was also developing new technology, stimulating ideas, and exciting school children. In the eyes of many, it was well worth the $10 million a year being spent on it. But almost exactly a year after authorizing it, Congress pulled the plug on NASA's SETI program. It cost too much, they said. The post-Cold War U.S. defense budget is some 30,000 times larger. The chief argument of the principal opponent of the NASA SETI program, Senator Richard Bryan of Nevada, was this, from the Congressional Record for September 22, 1993. So far, the NASA SETI program has found nothing. In fact, all the decades of SETI research have found no confirmable signs of extraterrestrial life. Even with the current NASA version of SETI, I do not think many of its scientists would be willing to guarantee that we are likely to see tangible results in the foreseeable future. Scientific research rarely, if ever, offers guarantees of success, and I understand that. And the full benefits of such research are often unknown until very late in the process. And I accept that as well. In the case of SETI, however, the chances of success are so remote, and the likely benefits of the program are so limited. There is little justification for $12 million taxpayer dollars to be expended for this program. But how, before we have found extraterrestrial intelligence, can we guarantee that we will find it? How, on the other hand, can we know that the chances of success are remote? And if we find extraterrestrial intelligence, are the benefits really likely to be so limited? As in all great exploratory ventures, we do not know what we will find, and we don't know the probability of finding it. If we did, we would not have to look. SETI is one of those search programs irritating to those who want well-defined cost-benefit ratios. Whether extraterrestrial intelligence can be found, how long it would take to find it, and what it would cost to do so are all unknown. The benefits might be enormous, but we can't really be sure of that either. It would, of course, be foolish to spend a major fraction of the national treasure on such ventures. But I wonder if civilizations cannot be calibrated by whether they pay some attention to trying to solve the great problems. Despite these setbacks, a dedicated band of scientists and engineers centered at the SETI Institute in Palo Alto, California, has decided to go ahead. Government or no government, NASA has given them permission to use the equipment already paid for. Captains of the electronics industry have donated a few million dollars. At least one appropriate radio telescope is available, and the initial stages of this grandest of all SETI programs is on track. If it can demonstrate that a useful sky survey is possible without being swamped by background noise, and especially if, as is very likely from the META experience, there are unexplained candidate signals, perhaps Congress will change its mind once more and fund the project. Meanwhile, Paul Horowitz has come up with a new program, different from META, different from what NASA was doing, called BETA. BETA stands for Billion Channel Extraterrestrial Assay. It combines narrowband sensitivity, wide frequency coverage, and a clever way to verify signals as they're detected. If the Planetary Society can find the additional support, this system, much cheaper than the former NASA program, should be on the air soon. Would I like to believe that with META, we've detected transmissions from other civilizations out there in the dark, sprinkled through the vast Milky Way galaxy? You bet. After decades of wondering and studying this problem, of course I would. To me, such a discovery would be thrilling. It would change everything. We would be hearing from other beings independently evolved over billions of years, viewing the universe perhaps very differently, probably much smarter, certainly not human. How much do they know that we don't? For me, no signals, no one calling out to us is a depressing prospect. Complete silence, says Jean-Jacques Rousseau in a different context, induces melancholy. It is an image of death. But I'm with Henry David Thoreau. Why should I feel lonely? Is not our planet in the Milky Way? The realization that such beings exist, and that, as the evolutionary process requires, they must be very different from us, would have a striking implication. Whatever differences divide us down here on Earth are trivial compared to the differences between any of us and any of them. Maybe it's a long shot, but the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence might play a role in unifying our squabbling and divided planet. It would be the last of the great demotions, a rite of passage for our species, and a transforming event in the ancient quest to discover our place in the universe. In our fascination with SETI, we might be tempted, even without good evidence, to succumb to belief. But this would be self-indulgent and foolish. We must surrender our skepticism only in the face of rock-solid evidence. Science demands a tolerance for ambiguity. Where we are ignorant, we withhold belief. Whatever annoyance the uncertainty engenders serves a higher purpose. It drives us to accumulate better data. This attitude is the difference between science and so much else. Science offers little in the way of cheap thrills. The standards of evidence are strict, but when followed, they allow us to see far, illuminating even a great darkness. Chapter 21. To the Sky. The stairs of the sky are let down for him that he may ascend thereon to heaven. O gods, put your arms under the king, raise him, lift him to the sky, to the sky, to the sky. Hymn for a Dead Pharaoh, Egypt, circa 2600 BC. When my grandparents were children, the electric light, the automobile, the airplane, and the radio were stupefying technological advances, the wonders of the age. You might hear wild stories about them, but you could not find a single exemplar in that little village in Austria-Hungary, near the banks of the River Bug. But in that same time, around the turn of the last century, there were two men who foresaw other, far more ambitious inventions. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the theoretician, a nearly deaf school teacher in the obscure Russian town of Kaluga, and Robert Goddard, the engineer, a professor at an equally obscure American college in Massachusetts. They dreamt of using rockets to journey to the planets and the stars. Step by step, they worked out the fundamental physics and many of the details. Gradually, their machines took shape. Ultimately, their dream proved infectious. In their time, the very idea was considered disreputable or even a symptom of some obscure derangement. Goddard found that merely mentioning a voyage to other worlds subjected him to ridicule, and he dared not publish or even discuss in public his long-term vision of flights to the stars. As teenagers, both had epiphanal visions of spaceflight that never left them. "I still have dreams in which I fly up to the stars in my machine," Tsiolkovsky wrote in middle age. "It is difficult to work all on your own for many years, in adverse conditions, without a gleam of hope, without any help." Many of his contemporaries thought he was truly mad. Those who knew physics better than Tsiolkovsky and Goddard, including the New York Times in a dismissive editorial not retracted until the eve of Apollo 11, insisted that rockets could not work in a vacuum, that the moon and the planets were forever beyond human reach. A generation later, inspired by Tsiolkovsky and Goddard, Wernher von Braun was constructing the first rocket capable of reaching the edge of space, the V-2. But in one of those ironies with which the 20th century is replete, von Braun was building it for the Nazis as an instrument of indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, as a vengeance weapon for Hitler. The rocket factory staffed with slave labor, untold human suffering exacted in the construction of every booster, and von Braun himself made an officer in the SS. He was aiming at the moon, he joked unselfconsciously, but hit London instead. Another generation later, building on the work of Tsiolkovsky and Goddard, extending von Braun's technological genius, we were up there in space, silently circumnavigating the Earth, treading the ancient and desolate lunar surface. Our machines, increasingly competent and autonomous, were spreading through the solar system, discovering new worlds, examining them closely, searching for life, comparing them with Earth. This is one reason that in the long astronomical perspective, there is something truly epochal about now, which we can define as the few centuries centered on the year you're reading this book. And there's a second reason. This is the first moment in the history of our planet when any species, by its own voluntary actions, has become a danger to itself, as well as to vast numbers of others. Let me recount the ways. We've been burning fossil fuels for hundreds of thousands of years. By the 1960s, there were so many of us burning wood, coal, oil, and natural gas on so large a scale that scientists began to worry about the increasing greenhouse effect. The dangers of global warming began slowly slipping into public consciousness. CFCs were invented in the 1920s and 1930s. In 1974, they were discovered to attack the protective ozone layer. 15 years later, a worldwide ban on their production was going into effect.